Chapter 32. I took my eyes from her face, and became aware that dusk was beginning to steal into the room. How strange it seemed. Except for the glazed rotunda part its long walls, divided into narrow panels separated by an order of flat pilasters, presented, depicted on a black background and in vivid colors, slender women with butterfly wings and lean youths with narrow bird's wings. The effect was supposed to be Pompeian, and Rita and I had often laughed at the delirious fancy of some enriched shopkeeper. But still it was a display of fancy, a sign of grace. But at that moment these figures appeared to me weird and intrusive, and strangely alive in their attenuated grace of unearthly beings concealing a power to see and hear. Without words, without gestures, Dona Rita was heard again. Tea may have been as near coming to pass as this. She showed me the breadth of her little fingernail. S, as near as that. Why? How? Just like that, for nothing. Because it had come up. Because a wild notion had entered a practical old woman's head. Yes. And the best of it is that I have nothing to complain of. Had I surrendered, I would have been perfectly safe with these two. It is they, or rather he, who couldn't trust me, or rather that something which I express, which I stand for. Mills would never tell me what it was. Perhaps he didn't know exactly himself. He said it was something like genius. My genius. Oh, I am not conscious of it. Believe me, I am not conscious of it. But if I were, I wouldn't pluck it out and cast it away. I am ashamed of nothing, of nothing. Don't be stupid enough to think that I have the slightest regret. There is no regret. First of all, because I am I, and then because... my dear, believe me, I have had a horrible time of it myself lately. This seemed to be the last word. Outwardly quiet, all the time, it was only then that she became composed enough to light an enormous cigarette of the same pattern as those made specially for the King Por El Rey. After a time, tipping the ash into the bowl on her left hand, she asked me in a friendly, almost tender, tone. What are you thinking of, amigo? I was thinking of your immense generosity. You want to give a crown to one man, a fortune to another. That is very fine. But I suppose there is a limit to your generosity somewhere. I don't see why there should be any limit to fine intentions. Yes, one would like to pay ransom, and be done with it all. That's the feeling of a captive, and yet somehow I can't think of you as ever having been anybody's captive. You do display some wonderful insight sometimes. My dear, I begin to suspect that men are rather conceited about their powers. They think they dominate us. Even exceptional men will think that. Men too great for mere vanity, men like Henry Alliger, for instance, who by his consistent and serene detachment was certainly fit to dominate all sorts of people. Yet for the most part they can only do it because women choose more or less consciously to let them do so. Henry Alliger, if any man, might have been certain of his own power, and yet, look. I was a chit of a girl, I was sitting with a book, where I had no business to be, in his own garden, when he suddenly came upon me, an ignorant girl of 17, a most uninviting creature with a tousled head, in an old black frock and shabby boots. I could have run away. I was perfectly capable of it. But I stayed looking up at him, and in the end it was he who went away, and it was I who stayed. Consciously? I murmured. Consciously? You may just as well ask my shadow, that lay so still by me on the young grass in that morning sunshine. I never knew before how still I could keep. It wasn't the stillness of terror. I remained, knowing perfectly well that, if I ran, he was not the man to run after me. I remember perfectly his deep-toned, politely indifferent "Restez donc." Apostrophe, apostrophe, he was mistaken. Already then I hadn't the slightest intention to move. And if you ask me again, how far conscious all this was, the nearest answer I can make you is this. That I remained on purpose, but I didn't know for what purpose I remained. Really, that couldn't be expected. Why do you sigh like this? Would you have preferred me to be idiotically innocent or abominably wise? These are not the questions that trouble me, I said. If I sigh, it is because I am weary. And getting stiff too, I should say, in this Pompeian armchair. You had better get out of it, and sit on this couch as you always used to do. That, at any rate, is not Pompeian. You have been growing of late extremely formal, I don't know why. If it is a pose, then for goodness' sake drop it. Are you going to model yourself on Captain Blunt? You couldn't, you know. You are too young. I don't want to model myself on anybody, I said. And anyway, Blunt is too romantic. And, moreover, he has been and is yet in love with you, a thing that requires some style, an attitude, something of which I am altogether incapable. You know it isn't so stupid, this what you have just said. Yes, there is something in this. I am not stupid, I protested, without much heat. Oh, yes, you are. You don't know the world enough to judge. You don't know how wise men can be. Owls are nothing to them. Why do you try to look like an owl? There are thousands and thousands of them waiting for me outside the door. The staring, hissing beasts. You don't know what a relief of mental ease and intimacy you have been to me in the frankness of gestures and speeches and thoughts, sane or insane, that we have been throwing at each other. I have known nothing of this in my life but with you. There had always been some fear, some constraint, lurking in the background behind everybody, everybody except you, my friend. An unmannerly, Arcadian state of affairs. I am glad you like it. Perhaps it's because you were intelligent enough to perceive that I was not in love with you in any sort of style. No, you were always your own self, unwise and reckless, and with something, in it kindred to mine, if I may say so without offense. You may say anything without offense. But has it never occurred to your sagacity that I just, simply, loved you? Just simply, she repeated in a wistful tone. You didn't want to trouble your head about it, is that it? My poor head. From your tone one might think you yearned to cut it off. No, my dear, I have made up my mind not to lose my head. You would be astonished to know how little I care for your mind. Would I? Come and sit on the couch all the same, she said after a moment of hesitation. Then, as I did not move at once, she added with indifference. You may sit as far away as you like, it's big enough, goodness knows. The light was ebbing slowly out of the rotunda, and to my bodily eyes she was beginning to grow shadowy. I sat down on the couch, and for a long time no word passed between us. We made no movement. We did not even turn towards each other. All I was conscious of was the softness of the seat, which seemed somehow to cause a relaxation of my stern mood, I won't say against my will, but without any will on my part. Another thing I was conscious of, strangely enough, was the enormous brass bowl for cigarette ends. Quietly, with the least possible action, Dona Rita moved it to the other side of her motionless person. Slowly, the fantastic women with butterflies' wings, and the slender-limbed youths with the gorgeous pinions on their shoulders, were vanishing into their black backgrounds with an effect of silent discretion, leaving us to ourselves. I felt suddenly extremely exhausted, absolutely overcome with fatigue, since I had moved. As if to sit on that Pompeian chair had been a task almost beyond human strength, a sort of labor that must end in collapse. I fought against it for a moment, and then my resistance gave way. Not all at once, but as if yielding to an irresistible pressure, for I was not conscious of any irresistible attraction, I found myself with my head resting, with a weight I felt must be crushing, on Dona Rita's shoulder, which yet did not give way, did not flinch at all. A faint scent of violets filled the tragic emptiness of my head, and it seemed impossible to me that I should not cry from sheer weakness. But I remained dry-eyed. I only felt myself slipping lower and lower, and I caught around the waist clinging to her, not from any intention but purely by instinct. All that time S. he hadn't stirred. There was only the slight movement of her breathing that showed her to be alive, and with closed eyes I imagined her to be lost in thought, removed by an incredible meditation, while I clung to her, to an immense distance from the earth. The distance must have been immense, because the silence was so perfect, the feeling as if of eternal stillness. I had a distinct impression of being in contact with an infinity that at the slightest possible rise and fall was pervaded by a warm, delicate scent of violets, and through which came a hand from somewhere to rest lightly on my head. Presently my ear caught the faint and regular pulsation of her heart, firm and quick, infinitely touching in its persistent mystery, disclosing itself into my very ear, and my felicity became complete. It was a dreamlike state combined with a dreamlike sense of insecurity. Then in that warm and scented infinity, or eternity, in which I rested lost in bliss, but ready for any catastrophe, I heard the distant, hardly audible, and fit to strike terror into the heart, ringing of a bell. At this sound the greatness of spaces departed. I felt the world close about me. The world of darkened walls, a very deep gray dusk against the panes, and I asked in a pained voice, "Why did you ring, Rita?" There was a bell rope within reach of her hand. I had not felt her move, but she said very low, "I rang for the lights." "You didn't want the lights." "It was time," she whispered secretly. Somewhere within the house a door slammed. I got away from her feeling small and weak, as if the best part of me had been torn away and irretrievably lost. Rose must have been somewhere near the door. "It's abominable," I murmured to the still, idol-like shadow on the couch. The answer was a hurried, nervous whisper. "Tell you it was time. I rang because I had no strength to push you away. I suffered a moment of giddiness before the door opened, light streamed in, and Rose entered, preceding a man in a green baize apron whom I had never seen, carrying on an enormous tray 3 argand lamps fitted in 2 vases of Pompeian form. Rose distributed them over the room. In the flood of soft light the winged youths and the butterfly women reappeared on the panels, affected, gorgeous, callously unconscious of anything having happened during their absence. Rose attended to the lamp on the nearest mantelpiece, then turned about and asked in a confident undertone, "Monsieur Dine?" I had lost myself with my elbows on my knees and my head in my hands, but I heard the words distinctly. I heard also the silence which ensued. I sat up and took the responsibility of the answer on myself. "Impossible. I am going to see this evening." This was perfectly true, only I had totally forgotten it till then. For the last 2 days my being was no longer composed of memories, but exclusively of sensations of the most absorbing, disturbing, exhausting nature. I was like a man who has been buffeted by the sea, or by a mob till he loses all hold on the world in the misery of his helplessness. But now I was recovering. And naturally the first thing I remembered was the fact that I was going to see. "You have heard, Rose," Dona Rita said at last with some impatience. The girl waited a moment longer before she said, "Oh, yes. There is a man waiting for Monsieur in the hall. A seaman. It could be no one but Dominic." It dawned upon me that since the evening of our return I had not been near him or the ship, which was completely unusual, unheard of, and well calculated to startle Dominic. "I have seen him before," continued Rose, "and as he told me he has been pursuing Monsieur all the afternoon, and didn't like to go away without seeing Monsieur for a moment, I proposed to him to wait in the hall till Monsieur was at liberty." I said, "Very well," and with a sudden resumption of her extremely busy, not a moment to lose manner, Rose departed from the room. I lingered in an imaginary world full of tender light, of unheard of colors, with a mad riot of flowers, and an inconceivable happiness under the sky arched above its yawning precipices, while a feeling of awe enveloped me like its own proper atmosphere. But everything vanished at the sound of Dona Rita's loud whisper full of boundless dismay, such as to make one's hair stir on one's head. "Mon Dieu! And what is going to happen now? She got down from the couch and walked to a window. When the lights had been brought into the room, all the panes had turned inky black. For the night had come, and the garden was full of tall bushes and trees screening off the gas lamps of the main alley of the Prado. Whatever the question meant, she was not likely to see an answer to it outside. But her whisper had offended me, had hurt something infinitely deep, infinitely subtle and infinitely clear-eyed in my nature. I said after her from the couch on which I had remained, "Don't lose your composure. You will always have some sort of bell at hand." I saw her shrug her uncovered shoulders impatiently. Her forehead was against the very blackness of the panes, pulled upward from the beautiful, strong nape of her neck. The twisted mass of her tawny hair was held high upon her head by the arrow of gold. "You set up for being unforgiving," she said without anger. I sprang to my feet, while she turned about, and came towards me bravely, with a wistful smile on her bold, adolescent face. "It seems to me," she went on in a voice like a wave of love itself, "that one should try to understand before one sets up for being unforgiving. Forgiveness is a very fine word. It is a fine invocation. There are other fine words in the language, such as fascination, fidelity, also frivolity, and as for invocations, there are plenty of them too. For instance, alas, heaven help me." We stood very close together. Her narrow eyes were as enigmatic as ever, but that face, which, like some ideal conception of art, was Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.